What I'm doing right now, we're gonna sign off. Start about next week, same place, same time, positive vibe. Keep you alive, 90.3 FM. I'll be myself and Johnny Black and Nadine, the member of positive vibe crew. Well, large up on yourself every time, yeah. Check out the Jamaica Association Overpool Friday.
What's up? This is Saul Williams chilling here in Montreal, here on CKUT. Peace.
We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war.
You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM. About anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
On this episode of From Embers, we're taking a look at a space called the Terrain Vague, which loosely translates into English as the wasteland. The Terrain Vague is a fairly large, deindustrialized, and partially wooded area on the outskirts of Hochelaga, a neighborhood in Montreal's East End, and importantly, very close to the Port of Montreal. I've been hearing about the Terrain Vague as a special fringe space for some years now, although I haven't personally been out there as of yet. And as you'll hear on the show, the space is under threat from several major development projects, both private and public. As a result, those that care about the Terrain Vague have been getting increasingly organized in the past year to develop an analysis of those developments in the context of a broader colonial capitalist strategy at play by the Quebec government, to make links with neighborhood groups like Mobilization 6600, and to take direct action to physically defend the space. I spoke with a Francophone anarchist from Montreal who's active in the defense of the Terrain Vague. For our listeners who don't understand French, I've included a few translated terms in the show notes. We spoke about the history and context of the Terrain Vague in Hochelaga, the Quebec government vision for the St. Lawrence River, logistical hubs as points of anarchist intervention, questions around settler-led land defense and how it relates to indigenous-led land defense, and how this project might connect to a renewed push to shut down Canada.
I'm an anarchist. I've been living in Montreal for around 10 years and organizing in Montreal for like 7 years or something like that. I live in Hochelag, and which is a neighborhood in Montreal where there's a high concentration of anarchists and radicals of all sorts. And in Hochelag, there is this very special place that we call the Terrain Vague, which means wasteland, that is in like an industrial zone that is abandoned. It used to be many things. At some point, part of it used to be a grocery store storage place. It's also the CN tracks run through it. It's very big. It's like maybe 2 kilometers long or something like that. All the neighborhood uses it for all sorts of things. Like people have fires there, people walk their dogs, people have queer raves, people hold rituals. Like during COVID, it was the only place where people could gather like outside. And it became like really, really, like people started just, the whole neighborhood started using it so much during COVID. But it's been a special place for people for a really long time. It's been like abandoned for 20 years or something like that, some part of it. Oh yeah, and people have been living there also.
I was sort of like looking up this term terrain vague. I know there's some kind of like urban planning book that was written in English about it. And they were saying some stuff about how it doesn't translate that well into English. Like wasteland doesn't quite capture what terrain vague means in French. So I guess maybe that's why everyone still calls it the terrain vague, even in English.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring up COVID because I guess a lot of our listeners wouldn't be in Quebec, and I know Quebec had some particularly restrictive conditions during COVID, and in particular like a curfew. So can you speak a bit about how people were using it during COVID?
Yeah, during curfew it was really hard. I think people were still using it, but like there was a curfew at times 8 p.m. and at other times 9 p.m. until 5 a.m. in the morning. Yeah, I wasn't in Montreal for a lot of the curfew. I like escaped. But I think it's more the restriction on getting together. At times we couldn't get together in parks, even at distance. Like you couldn't be more than 2 people in a park or something like that. I don't think it was really that enforced, but cops could decide to enforce it whenever they wanted. So that was the, like, because sometimes cops go into Terrain Vague, but a lot of the time they don't, and you can just hide in the little forest. And I think that's mostly how it was used.
I was wondering if you could also just provide some context on the neighborhood of Hochelag and some of the, like, anti-gentrification struggles and other struggles that have been playing out in the neighborhood that sort of relate to the terrain vague.
So Hochelaga is a predominantly white working class neighborhood on the southeastern part of the island. It's really close to the port, the industrial port. It's like on the outskirt of it. And that is an important information that's going to play out in when I talk about the struggle to defend terrain vague. And it's been under gentrification, like really high attacks of gentrification for the past 7 or 8 years. Probably people will say 10 years, but like it's how long I've been living in Hochelag, and I've witnessed it like really peak really, really hard in the past 5 years, I would say. But people have been struggling against gentrification since probably 2013 or 14. There was a time where there were a lot of actions, kind of like rolling actions of like broken windows, paint sprayed on storefronts. It did end up shutting down some stores. It got talked about a lot in the media. There were demos attacking cops a little bit. There were like more like family demos with community organizing. And I'm using past tense, not because it's over, but it feels like people are exhausted, or I hear less and less of anti-gentrification actions. And it's very depressing to walk around the neighborhood and see how it's changed. It's starting to look more and more like the hip neighborhoods of Montreal, like the Myland. And rent has increased like crazy, like almost doubled, like in some parts. Yeah. So I'm like, I feel a little defeated, but people have resisted a lot.
And do you see that struggle as connected or continuous with what's happening now in the Terrain Vague?
That's an interesting question, because what's happening in the Terrain Vague is not going to make the neighborhood nicer. So I'm not sure it's a gentrification issue. It's going to ruin the quality of life of the people who live on the outskirts of the Terrain Vague. Like the noise and quality of air and like vibration of the ground, all of that is going to be quite bad for the people who live close by. It's just going in the direction of this is a like shitty industrial neighborhood that we can just make more shitty and more industrial kind of vibe, and not caring for the well-being of the people who live there. So it's kind of like sacrificing the very end of the neighborhood. And when the nice part that is very gentrified is like quite far from it and won't like suffer from it that much.
I guess now would be a good time to ask you, like, what exactly is planned for that space by the government and by industry? And how does it relate to the broader infrastructural development plan that the provincial government has for the St. Lawrence River?
Yeah, so a lot of things are at play on that piece of land. It's owned by like four different bodies. A part of it is owned by the Ministry of Transport. A part of it is owned by Hydro-Québec. A part of it is owned by the CN. And finally, a part of it got bought that used to belong to the CN, I believe, by the logistical company Raymond Logistique, which is a logistic and transport of goods company that specializes in big containers, you know, the containers that boats carry and train. There's many projects threatening the Terrain Vague. Some of them we know little about, some of them are like unclear when they're going to happen. They're supposed to build a Hydro-Québec station on part of it. There's the project of a highway that will like connect a boulevard with the port. Because right, the Terrain Vague is like, there's like the Terrain Vague, a big road, and then the port. And there's a plan of like a big road crossing the whole Terrain Vague to just make the traffic more fluid between the highway and the port for trucks. But the big thing that people have been struggling against is what Raymond Logistique is doing, which is they're building an intermodal transshipment platform where trains arrive, like put their containers there, and then trucks from this platform. There's a new road. There's this other also new road being built between the Terrain Vague and the port, but to transport all day, all night, every day of the week, more than like 100 or around like 100 trucks every day, moving like 10,000 containers or something like that between the port and the platform. So yeah, we understand what Raymond Logistique is doing and how much like support it's getting from the government as part of what the government calls Avantage Saint-Laurent, which used to be called Stratégie Maritime du Québec. It got set up like 5 years ago or something like that. And the CAQ, the Quebec government, through that plan, wants to massively invest in the logistic and freight transport sector. And it like is stating that the St. Lawrence River has an underexploited potential and wants to develop its economic potential. And like it wants to make transport infrastructures more efficient. And also, and most importantly, create new industrial port zones, or like increase the capacity of the ones that already exist, like tremendously. Basically, like being very consistent in like seeing the St. Lawrence not as a river, but as a seaway and as a like tool for economy and transport, furthering really intensely the like colonial history of that river, which is destroying it to transport goods.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading a bit about Raymont Logistics and what else they do, and ended up going down a rabbit hole into logistics and commodity transport. And it's such a strange world. Like, you know, like their whole business at West is these plastic pellet packaging factories. It's just so weird when you dig into this stuff. And I think there has been more interest among radicals, anarchists and communists in the question of logistics and as a point of intervention, of anti-capitalist intervention. Do you think that's partly what has drawn people into this struggle in Montreal?
Everyone wants to like bloquer les flux and all of that. But it's not like this specific struggle is really grounded in people's everyday life. And the first impulse that I read for most people is to defend that place that they love. It makes so much sense because it's embedded in this governmental strategy and like capitalist strategy that is like a very potent example of everything that we want to fight against. It really comes from just like this place that this like little wood that you go to every day to like sit and relax and have fires with your friend, and that threatening not to exist anymore.
You're listening to From Embers, a weekly show of anarchist and anti-authoritarian politics, airing every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, and podcasting online in your favorite podcast app. You can find all our back shows on fremembers.libsyn.com. On this episode, we are speaking with a Francophone anarchist from Montreal who is participating in the defense of the Terrain Vague, a large deindustrialized and wooded area on the outskirts of Hochelaga, which is a neighborhood in Montreal's East End, and is currently under threat by a major logistical series of developments spearheaded by the Quebec government. Could you talk a bit about the what has happened so far in terms of the struggle to defend the Terrain Vague and who the different protagonists of that struggle are and the relationship to the neighborhood.
So Raymond Logistic bought part of the Terrain Vague in 2015, I think. The first big destruction of it happened in 2016. And at that time, everyone just got really, really surprised. It happened really quickly. And what used to be a forest and little bushes and weird pools in concrete where there were fish and where people were swimming, all of that, like some morning we wake up, we go take a walk and it's not there anymore. And people started looking into what was going on. And at the times, like among radicals, there were like some efforts of organizing some events, but people, I think, felt really overwhelmed and didn't really know what to do and how to tackle that. And it was a lot of grief also because it just happened so suddenly and people felt like powerless. Well, I know I did. And there was kind of a, in the circles that I know, not that much that was happening. At the same time, though, like a citizen group formed called Mobilisation 6600. And they started being very active in a more like public and like citizen way of acting. They're called Mobilisation 6600 because 6600 is the number of signatures they wanted to get on this petition to stop the Raymond Logistic project.
That's 6,600, right?
Yeah. I didn't know them at the time. And I think most anarchists didn't even know they existed. But I think they've been doing like a lot of work since then and quite important work in the big picture. And we'll say a year and a half. And then it was at night. We were having a fire in the little woods on the northern side of the Terrain Vague. And there's bulldozer coming. And we're like, whoa, what is happening? And that was like on the Ministry of Transport part of the Terrain Vague. And so everyone freaked out and we were like, okay, this can't happen again on this other part of the Terrain Vague. And people got really, really like organized really quickly, ready to defend that part of the Terrain Vague. Then we discovered this plan of the Ministry of Transport to build that part, that like a section of highway that I was talking about earlier. This was kind of a wake-up call, and people started looking at Raymond Logistic more. And also, Raymond Logistic, throughout the last year, started working more and more on the piece of the Terrain Vague they claimed they owned. And I think I get confused because it's very shady and complicated, but there was a lot of citizen opposition like in the neighborhood to Raymond Logistic. Like, no one is for that project. Literally no one. The city of Montreal sued Raymond Logistic to try to stop that project from happening. And then they lost. And so Raymond Logistic resumed their work. In the past year, it's like struggle has become like really intensified. And Raymond Logistic has started working more and more. And anarchists met Mobilisation 6600 and there started to be some collaboration. Like a lot of like information, like spreading information, like postering, graph, small publications, like a plant and birds identification zine, for example. There's been some like small blockades, like small, like occasional blockades. I mean, small. Sometimes it was like 50 people. Sometimes it was like more 20 people. I'm small in the terms that it wasn't intended to like remain there for a long time. It was just like to disrupt the work that was happening on the work site for a few hours or for the day. And it succeeded many times. And also to like draw attention to what was going on there. I've heard of like small like disruption of the work site, such as messing with surveying gear, like removing the poles, which I've heard has happened. And then like really like fucks up with their day, even their week probably. At the end of the summer, there were arson attempts of the equipment of Raymond Logistic. And Raymond Logistic came out in the media saying he feared for his employees and blah, blah, blah. And that got talked about a lot. there have been many events held at the Terrain Vague also, parties, but also like conferences, discussions, barbecues, organizing meetings happening at the Terrain Vague in order to connect with more people. Demos, mostly like Mobilisation 6600, the citizen organization, have organized like a few like big family type of demo. They're working hard on their petition still. I think they're just increasing their numbers, their numbers of signatures. There were like people made gardens at the Terrain Vague. There were like tree planting events in parts of it. You know, like a really like large range of tactics from planting a tree to an arson attempt, you know.
I'm curious about that. Like when those more confrontational things happened, arson or blockades, was that condemned by Mobilisation 6600, or have people been able to work together even if they don't use all the same tactics?
Nothing was ever condemned by Mobilisation 6600, which I think is really cool and interesting. No, yeah, for the reaction to the arson attempts was very interesting. The Terrain Vague stuff has been getting quite a bit of media coverage, a lot because Mobilisation 6600 does a lot of work to reach out to media. And so journalists like reached out to them when that happened. And I thought the spokespeople did a really clever intervention. And they were kind of like, we don't do that. Obviously, it's not the tactics that we use. And like really like separating themselves from that. But then moving the question on the question of violence, like people say that's violent. But when I look at what the Raymond Logistique is doing to that land and to the neighborhood, that is violence. And like what has happened is nothing in comparison to that. Which I thought was a clever way to put it. No, in for like the blockades that have happened, I think they've been very supportive of it. It's like it's been an interesting encounter. And I say they, like it's a very large. There's like a core group of people who have been organizing a lot, but they connect with like hundreds of people in the neighborhood, and it's not a coherent group also. So I can just speak of like what I've heard, but it's important to not just frame them as this homogeneous group, because they aren't. But from what I've heard and seen, they want stuff like the blockades to happen, and they're like happy to have met the like radicals who like are down to organize such things. Like they won't do it, or they will do it in a milder way, but they're happy it's happening. I think some people, some radicals at times have tried to organize more closely with them. I was talking with a friend about it, and they were like, we reached a point where we realized it wasn't that much of a good idea because all sorts of issues like security practice issues. And it just got tiring for people to explain that over and over, that like you it would be a good idea to not bring your phone, and like people would argue about that or something like that. And because in organizing those things with them, like my friend who I was talking to was saying that they realized that they like toned down their desires. And at some point they realized that shouldn't happen. If there was a period where people tried to organize like higher intensity actions with Mobilisation 6600, because it seemed like there was an opening, that like stopped happening. But kind of like Mobilisation 6600 is doing their thing, and the radicals are doing their thing. And like people are in good terms, and like Mobilisation 6600 does this like important work, I think, in such struggle to like make it public, make it visible, and to draw attention to it in a, and to like draw more and more people to it and speak to the media and stuff like that. And then the radicals are doing their like more intense tactics, and that seemed to go well together.
I'm curious what people kind of want to see happen. I know some of the narratives from the neighborhood have been about developing a park instead of the Raymond Logistics development. And then some of the slogans from the radicals have been something along the lines of the terrain vague stays vague or vacant. Yeah. What do you hope to see happen there, and how is that being framed?
Mm-hmm. It's a good following question to what I was saying, because that's one of the, if it's been interesting to see how anarchists and radicals and Mobilisation Simul 600 can work in parallel and kind of get together and like be complementary. That question is where it breaks, because yeah, Mobilisation Simul 600 wants this place to be turned into a park, like a parc nature in French. I don't know, like a nature park for the forest to be preserved, and like maybe having like bike paths and things like that. And we are much more interested in how like the terrain vague as it is escapes the controlled grid of the city. And it's this weird liminal space where all sorts of things can happen, where people can live, where it can be like a cruising spot. It can be a place where queer dance parties happen. It can be a place where like rituals are held, and it's not cleaned, and it's not controlled, and it's maybe not safe. And we're like, the like perspective of it becoming a park, like becoming another controlled zone of the city, is extremely sad to me. And so that's what like the terrain vague restera vague means. Because such spaces are so, so, so rare in the city. Yeah, spaces that evade control.
I mean, it's funny to hear you talk about it, because I feel like on a smaller, much smaller scale, there's a development in Kingston that had the almost the same dynamics, where the city wanted to build a road through a park that, or through a green space, basically, that was on the river. The neighborhood was gentrifying around it. There were a bunch of anarchists who were like, keep it sketchy was basically what, like, you know, people were like, could drink openly in the park, and like, you never see cops there or whatever. And there was this sort of like three-way thing happening with, and gentrification was a big part of it, because the park essentially contributed to the gentrification of it, but it stopped the road. But yeah, it's just really familiar to hear you talk about it in that way, because I think the people I know who care about it as a wild space, care about it as a space where people can, yeah, there was cruising, there was drinking, there was, you know, just outside of the eyes of the law.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really, really alike. What happened to that place?
Half of it is a park with a sanctioned graffiti wall. And there was the design for it that was called Articulated Wild, which was like basically a landscaped swamp. Things were planted. So it's fine. I mean, it's probably still better than a road. But there's another property just to the north of it that is an old tannery that is still like a wooded area that is really contaminated, and people live there. And then there's a condominium development that's proposed for it, and that's become the new kind of focal point for the same dynamics, I would say. But there's less neighborhood involvement, because a lot of people in the neighborhood don't go there because they think it's sketchy and they don't like it. So it plays out differently. It's almost like, you know, it's a good strategy to get people to use a space to defend it, because like you said, you become personally invested, you emotionally care about the space, and that's so important for people to, you know, risk themselves to defend something or even just to put their time in. But the vision for the space can sometimes become a point of tension.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of us has happened in the past year. A lot of what we've been trying to do, everyone, like citizens and anarchists, and is like reinforce that attachment to the place and like have all sorts of events happening and to like intensify how we live and exist there to like to like, yeah, so that people like really really want to fight for it. And but like no one created that through the struggle. Like it's, that's what makes that place so special, is that the like how much people like live there and care and use that place. It's been like that for way longer than Raymond Logistique has threatened it. But yeah, like the outcome, one of the things that are very complicated about this struggle is what we want in the end, this outcome. Because like, if you want a park, then there's a plan, then it's understandable. It's maybe like, you want the city to get involved to buy it, you want the city to do something with it. But if we want it to stay wild, like it doesn't fit in the logic of how land is organized. Like there's like the question of demand becomes like tricky, because okay, if we don't want Raymond Logistique to keep on working, we don't want Hydro-Québec to build their post, we don't want the Ministry of Transport to build their road. We want it to stay just like this, which is like it's owned by all those bodies. Realistically, it's really unclear what can happen. We want all those people to like remain, like to still own those places but do nothing with them. That's not realistic. Like there's the question of like property of land we have to ask ourselves the question of property, which is like, it really sucks because no one wants to own the land. But how can it stay wild? Like someone has to own it, sadly, in how the world functions. And we reach kind of a dead end there.
Yeah, I feel like that's a good segue to the next thing I wanted to ask, which is, well, people everywhere, but also in Montreal, that there's been a lot of anarchist participation in Indigenous-led land defense struggles, whether it's solidarity with Wet'suwet'en or Land Back Lane at Six Nations, Tyendinaga, also with the moose hunt with Algonquins up north. I'm wondering how that has informed this struggle and whether, like, it's my understanding this is a mainly settler-led, the defense of the Terrain Vague. But, like, do you consider it like a land defense struggle? And how does it relate to and differ from Indigenous-led land defense?
Yeah, I think it's fair to call that a land defense struggle. And you're right, it's not only settler-led, it's probably only settler involved that I know of. The main, like, most important difference that has to be said is that, like, Indigenous people have a claim to this land, and we don't. And so there's, like, the whole framework of, like, why you're defending a piece of land is very different. And like, it's not about property, you know, it's about, when I say like Indigenous people have a claim to the land, they don't necessarily claim they want to like own it the way a company wants to own it, but they want to be like, they want to care for it, and they were displaced from their land and they want to have the right to use it. Like all of that is not something that has happened to settlers. We were the one doing it. It's a more complicated position to navigate. But I think it's still important for settlers to like care for the land that we're on, because we're on it, you know? And like what is at play at the Terrain Vague is like part of the bigger like project of intensifying colonial extractive industry. And so to try to stop that is to try to stop a little part of that big machine, in the sense that it opposes colonial extractive industry. I think it has this like anti-colonial perspective. Like a lot of the people who have been implicated in defending the Terrain Vague have been, the same people have been doing solidarity work with the indigenous struggles you were talking about. And I think, and it's been like really, it's just been nice to like, to talk with like people at Land Back or at the Moose Moratorium about like this thing that we do at home and how like, how we care for the land where we live also. And that like, that we're grounded in the place that we live and that we want to like defend the wild there. I think it makes sense. And like, we've had like cool discussions about that. And I think people can connect on that. And it's obviously like a very different situation. It's really not the same, but there's like a connection of caring for the land and for wild spaces that is there and that we can relate on and draw inspiration from. Yeah, it's always tricky to like, sometimes like people equate like all, like make equal all land defense struggles, like indigenous and non-indigenous land. And I think that's a mistake. And I think it's always really important to talk about how much the stakes are higher for indigenous people defending their land in terms of like the impact that it has on their life and the like history of that, and also like the repression that is going to come. And like, it is complicated to defend a land when you're a settler also, but like the history is way less loaded and like the consequences you're going to face are going to be way less intense. And like, I think settler-led land defense can coexist with indigenous land defense projects, but really shouldn't be put like on the same level or something. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, in the winter of 2020, after the RCMP raids at Wet'suwet'en in service of the Coastal GasLink pipeline, there was a wave of actions, unprecedented probably in Canada, at least since OCA, of targeting, under the banner Shut Down Canada, targeting roads, railways, ports, the economic infrastructure of the country, basically, in support of that land defense struggle. And right now, in the fall of 2021, we're seeing a renewed push out west to defend the river and the drilling under the river. And already actions have started, including a brief rail blockade in Montreal last week I saw. I'm wondering if you think this struggle to defend the Terrain Vague could play a role if another wave of Shut Down Canada actions emerges this year.
That would be awesome. That would be an excellent connection to make for sure. Because if people are able to disrupt this project of like, it's just planning to make the poor more efficient. And if people can disrupt with that, it's like totally in line with the Shut Down Canada idea.
I mean, this is maybe a tangent, but do people think of it as Canada or do people think of it as Quebec? Like, would it be Shut Down Quebec in this case? Or, you know what I mean?
Huh. Well, in the winter of 2020, it was like everything that was happening in Quebec was under the banner of Shut Down Canada. Even things that like even if things that were disrupted were like, there was like some disruption of the port at some time. I don't think it was very efficient, but it was like, it was then under the government of Quebec. But because it's all part of the same big system, like trains travel throughout the country. So if we like, I don't know, like the grain trains that like are supposed to arrive at the Terrain Vague when it's going to be that transshipment platform, there may be from out west, like there could be some research done, but
Yeah.
I think the infrastructures of the government of Quebec like relate to the infrastructures of Canada.
Of course. Yeah. I'm still just trying to wrap my mind around how sort of anti-colonial politics play out in the Quebec context. It's really interesting to me. Mm. Just maybe like if people want to follow what's going on or learn more about the Terrain Vague in the context, where would you direct people?
So there's a Facebook page, Le Terrain Vague n'est à personne. which is another slogan that people came up with in the past years. That means that Taivag doesn't, like, belongs to no one. But I don't think it's very active. It's like, it has its times. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Mobilisation 6600 is quite active on social media, and they relay a lot of information. They would be, like, good to follow. Sometimes, like, news come up on Contrepoint Media or Montreal Counter Info. But there's not, like, anarchists don't have, like, a steady, like, platform of information about the Taivag.
This concludes our episode for today. You've been listening to From Embers, a weekly radio show and podcast covering anarchist ideas and practice. We air every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston. You can find us online at fromembers.libsyn.com or just simply search From Embers in your favorite podcast app. The music you heard tonight was from Total Nada and Blemish, two Montreal-based bands that have played shows in the Terrain Vague. You can find Total Nada at totalnada.bandcamp.com. You can find Blemish at awd-tapes.bandcamp.com. Send us an email at fromembers@riseup.net.
Slaves looking for relief from the steaming hot plate of bullshit served up on the daily by the mainstream media? Are you thirsting for solid and reliable information to escape the mind-numbing vortex of corporate news and Trump tweets? Are you ready to check out every time you hear Despacito on the radio one more fucking time? Then tune your dial to Sub.media, a mouth-watering hub of infotainment and subversion that'll make you want to quit your job and join the motherfucking resistance. Dive into our newly designed website and gorge yourself on one of the 500-plus videos and audio tracks from our vast library of anarchist films, hip-hop, and riot porn, or choose from one of our original shows, like Trouble, Burning Cop Car, A is for Anarchy, Video Ninja Reports, and The Stimulator. F*** Netflix. Watch Sub.media.
Esto es únicamente una prueba. Uno, dos, uno, dos.
In Montreal.
CKUT. All the rhythms, all the music, all the time.
90.3 FM. Ici Martin Carly, vulgarisateur scientifique. La vaccination des 5 à 11 ans contre la COVID-19 est commencée. En tant que parent, vous vous demandez peut-être si le vaccin est sécuritaire et efficace. La réponse est oui. Le vaccin est approuvé par Santé Canada et a fait l'objet d'études de qualité portant sur des milliers de personnes, dont des jeunes. Des experts suivent aussi de très près toute manifestation indésirable qui pourrait survenir après la vaccination.
Pour plus d'informations, rendez-vous sur québec.ca/vaccinjeunes. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gayla Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlawitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
Jason Whitebear is one of our youngest panelists. He is a residential school survivor.
Gaki waku maganak, nidi mwendin naganag. How mataki was. I said all my relations in three different languages. Those languages were taken away and given with this one here that I've mastered in residential school. And they told me that once you go there, he says, you're not going to come home with this anymore. You're not going to come home being able to speak Nehewewan. You're not going to be able to speak. But when you do go, what I want you to do is I want you to try and master everything that they give you so that they can never fool us anymore. In my generation, we're at the point now where we understand the nuances between the languages. We can say, bonjour, Anin. I wish I knew a little bit of Arab, but you know, the point being is that we're all sitting around here and we're very learned people. We're very knowledgeable. We know how to say, to say a little bit of each other's language nowadays. And that's just us as this. And I think that's a direct result of residential school, is because we always ask each other, where are you from? Well, how do you say this? How do you say that? So that when you run into somebody else, you're allowed to respect them and say, Tanse, how? Wuju Anin. So regardless of what was taken away from me during my residential school formative years, I haven't lost the ability to see. And so it is with this that I thank each and every one of you. I'd like to say, Ninanaskamun, Gakyogi Gwayotsiwa Taaski, and that's Cree for I'm grateful for everything in this land. I had to learn that from a kukum, because I was speaking in front of chiefs one time and I said, I can't speak the language. So she taught me that little bit. Ninanaskamutaman, Gakyogi Gwayotsiwa Taaski. Hi, hi. Thank you.
You have just heard at Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
Changeable, accepting, merging water moves fluidly from one form to another, easily transitioning from cloud to raindrop to sea. Forever changing form but not essence, water passes through barriers that are impossible to cross in any other way. Water knows no boundaries. Indiscriminately merging with anything and everyone, water unifies. It's in its nature to connect and merge. Water is generous, sometimes a little too generous, overflowing with bounty and causing a flood. Yet, a stable earthen container or seawall finds water committed to taking shape as a reflecting pool, cove, or lake. Just as the sea refuses passage to no one, water accepts all who come its way. Water accepts all walks of life, and we gratefully surrender and open to this healing element.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.